Are all the, okay, so we have everybody here.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Kevin Hanchett for the appellant, Elliot Severson. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
All right.
There are three central issues on appeal before the Court today. The first is whether Mr. Severson should be liable for attorney's fees on the SR development note when the guarantee was limited to the payment of just principal and interest. The second issue is whether the security addendum created a valid right to allow the respondent to encumber the Lakemont building with a deed of trust. And finally, whether Larasco had substantial justification to file a list pendens against Lakemont building.
Let me ask you a question about the second of those issues, and that's the additional security.
Yes, Your Honor.
I'm looking at the document called Addendum to Promissory Note, Additional Security, and I want to make sure I understand what this purports to do. Is it fair to say that there was to be collateral for the note?
Well, the addendum provided that if there was going to be a default, then there'd be collateral for the note.
So in a usual loan transaction, collateral is given at the time the note was executed, but it's your understanding that collateral only was to be provided in the form of a deed of trust upon default?
That's what the document provides for, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
Getting back to the first point, it's clear that we have two types of agreements here. We have the primary obligation that's owed by SR Development, and we have the guarantee that was signed by Mr. Severson. The guarantee states specifically, the undersigned as a direct and primary obligation hereby jointly and severally unconditionally guarantees the prompt payment of principal and interest on promissory note number 08-002.
Executed on even date herewith when and as due in accordance with its terms.
That's how the quotation continues. That's correct, Your Honor.
So, I mean, let's just make sure we get all those words in there.
That particular document, however, has no provision that the guarantor is agreeing to pay the attorney's fees associated with that obligation. It limits it very specifically to the prompt payment of principal and interest. This is very similar to the Sauter versus Houston case, where the guarantee was deemed by the court to be a separate contract.
The which case?
The Sauter versus Houston casualty.
Thank you.
I may be pronouncing the first name incorrectly. In that case, the court said we have two documents. We need to look at the documents as independent, integrated documents and make a determination as to what the rights and obligations of the parties are under that document. Here, there's no doubt SR Development agreed to pay attorney's fees. There's also no dispute and no doubt that Mr. Severson did not agree to pay the attorney's fees in the event of a default by that obligor. Because the guarantee is an independent contract, the guarantors are not liable beyond the express terms of the guarantee as set forth in the Kinney versus Reed case.
What is, let's just take a look here at the North Pacific Finance case, because that is a case where The Supreme Court held that a guarantor was liable for attorney's fees, even though there wasn't any express guarantee.
What the court found in that case, Your Honor, was that the document itself, again, determined the rights and obligations of the parties. And in that case, it says all costs of default shall be borne by the guarantor. So although it didn't specifically say attorney's fees, it was a broader description of the obligations the guarantor had under that arrangement.
Well, the language was, it seems to me the guarantee was a guarantee of all monies due or to become due under a different contract includes an award of attorney's fees if that contract has an attorney fee provision.
So, absolutely.
Okay, so how is that different from guaranteeing principal and interest on a promissory note when and as due in accordance with its terms?
Because, Your Honor, the statement that all monies due under that obligation is a much broader expression of the obligation of the guarantor than a statement that only the principal and interest under that contract. It was a very, very exclusionary type of language that was prepared by Larasco and given to Mr. Severson to sign. So if there's any ambiguity about the document, it's construed against the drafter, in this case, which was Larasco. So we need to look, and that case actually supports our position because it's a much broader scope of the guarantee in the language referencing the other document.
So you agree that it's fair to say that if you guarantee all monies due or to become due under a contract, that attorney fees fall into the category of all monies due or to become due?
I do, Your Honor. So if you have that language where you say anything that's owed on that obligation is now covered by the guarantee, it would be covered by the guarantee. In this case, we had it limited to principal and interest with no reference to attorney's fees. The second point, Your Honor, in this case is that in regards to the issuance of this deed of trust, it's clear that at the time the documents were prepared, no deed of trust was attached as an exhibit. There was no negotiations about the terms and conditions of the deed of trust. Not only that, but there was not even a legal description of the property. All we had was an address saying that if there's a default in the future, a deed of trust will be issued against this piece of property at this physical street address. This does not meet the requirements under the Sutherland v. Firestone case. You cannot agree to attach an agreement later on that's going to have independent terms and conditions that need to be negotiated and agreed upon by the parties.
Was a deed of trust ever provided for your client to sign?
Only post-judgment, Your Honor. After the trial in this matter, they came in with what they called a simple deed of trust and said, here's what we mean. That has no meaning.
And was that executed by your client?
It was executed pursuant to court order, Your Honor.
Okay. So not and was it recorded that. Against the property?
It was, Your Honor.
And the property was sold?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And funds were dispersed?
To pay the judgment in full, Your Honor, yes.
Okay, thank you.
So my client was put in a very untenable position because he had a court order that required him to sign a deed of trust that contained terms and conditions that had never been discussed at all and was characterized merely as being a simple or form deed of trust. That just does not meet the standard under the statute of frauds for how you are going to encumber property. More importantly, the owner of the property was not a party to this agreement. This is like me pledging your house with a deed of trust to a third party without your consent. There's no dispute that all the individuals were involved as members of various LLCs that had an interest in this property, but the property owner itself was not the party that was part of the transaction. So the court not only compelled a deed of trust on the property, but it was signed by a non-property owner. So we again have a violation of the chain of how the process should have occurred. They could have easily, at the time of the original transaction, attached a deed of trust, required that the party that had the authority to sign on behalf of the LLC present a member consent that gave them authority to do this, signed in that capacity.
I'd like to know these two related arguments about the deed of trust. You're saying, number one, it violated the statute of frauds because it did not contain a legal description, and there was something else you said about it, that it was something about...
It didn't contain all the terms of forfeiture, the terms of default for support senior liens, et cetera.
Right.
And then in addition to that, the deed of trust was being compelled to be issued by a non-party to the transaction.
Okay, but you mentioned a case, I guess, in connection with the first part of that.
Oh, I did, Your Honor.
I'm just not sure that I remember...
The Sutherland versus Firestone case.
Firestone, okay.
In that case, right. The agreement provided that a deed of trust would be attached later on. The deed of trust was not attached at the time of the transaction. Later on, the broker sent the deed of trust to the party saying, please sign this. The court found that was inadequate to have a valid contract in the first instance because a critical part was missing.
And is there a particular case that you think is really determinative of the next part of your argument, the one about the owner of the property wasn't the one that was compelled to sign?
Yes, Your Honor. I think the Hubble case and the Hubble case.
Okay, Hubble. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
May it please the court, I represent Lorasco, Inc., Lucy Court, and Dixie Court, and my name is Spencer Hall.
Thank you.
And we're the respondents. I'm not quite clear in terms of the defendants in this case had a fight and there was a motion to strike, but if the court's going to permit argument by...
No, the court is going to grant the motion to strike. We will not be hearing from the Roberts.
Okay. All right, then
but you may proceed and take the entire 10 minutes.
Thank you. That was my question.
Yeah.
From respondent's perspective, the question in this case is not legal. It's whether there's substantial evidence to support Judge Spector's findings below. I do not believe that appellant's statement of the record is accurate, and I would note.
No, just sit down. You'll have your 2 minutes.
No, Your Honor.
Oh, you're okay. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
You're quite right.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I thought you were trying to interrupt.
Not loud.
Just before I forget,
because you can start over.
Okay. The appellants think the question is whether there's substantial evidence to sustain Judge Spector's findings of fact. And these are not legal questions. None of these agreements were integrated, and I don't think there's any legal issue here. This is a factual case. With all due respect to Mr. Hanchett, I believe on the deed of trust issue, he made a couple of statements that are not supported by the record. One is, he is correct, there was no deed of trust attached to the addendum originally. And so consequently, plaintiffs, respondents here, prepared a deed of trust that said nothing more than this deed of trust secures the obligation set forth in the promissory note. That's all it said. We didn't ask for any extra provisions about default or anything like that you'd find in a lot of bank deeds of trust. And that was presented pre-judgment. It was presented at trial. They were asked to sign it. They refused. And Judge Spector said they were obligated to execute that.
Counsel argues, and I think I understand him to say, that it's the Firestone case that he thinks is quite influential on this point. Would you address that?
I don't think the Firestone case does address this. All the cases that they cited are cases where parties were quibbling about different provisions, where one wanted a provision the other hadn't agreed to, and we simply had no provisions like that in this case. If you take the documents together, the promissory note, the security addendum, all the material terms were present. The amount of the debt, the interest rate, the date of default. Now, they say there was no legal description. But again, none of the cases they cite are dispositive of that, because in this case, unlike all the cases they cite, it was not like me selling my property to John Doe or me buying property for John Doe. This was a case where these parties together owned a property. And in the case below, there was an LLC agreement that's an exhibit, and it's in the record on appeal, that contained the legal description for this property. And so when they signed this agreement saying that if you default on this loan, you will give us a deed of trust on this property. This was a property where they had a document with a legal description present. And so you take the documents together, and all the essential terms were there. And that's what Judge Spector found. It's kind of like me saying that if I own a property together with Mr. Doe, and we each own 50%, and I sign an agreement that I'm going to sell him my 50% and say I'm going to sell you my half of the property we own at such and such address, him then saying, you know what, I can get out of this because you didn't put the legal description in here. That's very different than when you're dealing with strangers and a property that they don't both own. And so there simply is no problem there. But the thing I wanted to note, and I don't know if it's significant, is Mr. Hanchett is wrong. Mr. Severson never caused the entity to sign the deed of trust as Judge Spector ordered. Post-judgment, Mr. Severson prepared his own deed of trust worded differently than what Judge Spector had ordered him to sign. And then he signed that and shipped it over to us. We declined to record it because it didn't comply with her judgment. And then he went ahead and sold his property that was supposed to have a deed of trust on it, but never did, and sent the money over to us to satisfy the judgment, because Judge Spector's ruling, I guess, created a cloud on the title, and so he felt he had to pay us the money. But the deed of trust was never recorded.
So you've been paid?
Yes.
Okay.
Judgment has been satisfied. Okay. That's absolutely correct. And on the guarantee issue and the attorney fee and the guarantee issue, the court, I think it was Judge Becker, pointed out the North Pacific Finance Corporation versus Howell Thompson case, and that is a case right on point. But that case also cites an earlier case by our Supreme Court, Bank of California versus Union Packing Company. And actually, the Bank of California case has the facts that are most akin to our case here. And in that case, the guarantee said, we hereby jointly and severally authorize and request you to advance to Union Packing Companies such monies as they may require from time to time, and for value received, we jointly and severally guarantee payment of whatever balance may remain due. And I think fairly construed, that is the guarantor saying they're going to pay whatever balance of these advances remain due. That's all they're saying. There's not any broader language about we guarantee everything in the note. And the Supreme Court had absolutely no problem stepping up and saying you guarantee the balance, you guarantee the attorney's fees if they're not paid. There was no additional language. And in that case, I don't even think there was any testimony. Now, in this case, unlike all these cases, there was a very significant fact here. We sued not only Mr. Severson, but we sued Mark Roberts, Ed Roberts, and we sued the company. And two out of these three defendants who were aligned with Mr. Severson when this started and were on the other side, they basically reached a point where they said to the court, you know, the plaintiff is right. They are right. They're right about this. The money is owed. We owe attorney's fees. We just don't want to keep fighting and running up
the bill. Well, that's fine. But, I mean, the person that's here now that's arguing is Mr. Severson, and he's asking the court to focus on the language of the guarantee. And it's that particular language that I think is what we are focusing on, because it says I unconditionally guarantee payment of principal and interest on the note. Okay, and then it says when and as due in accordance with its terms, but grammatically, how can that guarantee anything more than the prompt payment of principal and interest on the note?
My answer to that would be
Supreme Court said so.
Because the Supreme Court said so. It's exactly like the Bank of California case where they said they guaranteed advances, and that's all they said. And the court said, well, if there's attorney's fees due on the underlying note, they're due. But I don't think, I mean, I think if that note had said we guarantee principal interest and only principal interest and not attorney's fees, it would be clear and unambiguous. But it just stopped there and didn't speak to that. And what I'm saying is that other people who signed that very guarantee, who were Mr. Severson's partners, stepped up and told the trial court, we think that means we owe attorney's fees. That was the intent all along. And if you look at the
Why would we necessarily be bound or heavily influenced by what they did? I mean, the point is Mr. Severson is here. He didn't throw in the towel, and he's presenting this argument. So whatever somebody else might have thought those words mean, he gets to ask us what they mean, doesn't he?
He gets to, but if that contract, if this court rules that that contract taken with the other agreements, because it's not an integrated document, if you rule, contrary to what I think the facts are, that that's an integrated, clear, and unambiguous document, then yes, testimony is irrelevant. But I don't think it was clear and unambiguous. I don't think it was integrated. And the trial court took evidence. And part of that evidence was Mr. Severson's partner saying, yes, that's what it means. We owe attorney's fees.
All right, okay.
And so then the question becomes not a question of law, but whether taken into account the testimony of all the parties to this transaction, is Judge Spector's conclusion supported by substantial evidence?
Well, okay, so then I guess the question is, are we into Berg versus Huddisman territory here? I mean, in other words, what is the meaning of this language? And you're saying the context and various other forms of extrinsic evidence can come in.
Absolutely. Could and did, and there was no objection to it.
I see.
None whatsoever.
All right. Okay.
And so that's what happened. And that's why I think the question is there substantial evidence to support the conclusion? And the judgment's been satisfied, and there are a lot of arguments in here, but I think our brief adequately addresses those. So unless the court has other questions, I'll sit down.
Well, right on time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honor, a few points I'd like to bring up in response to the argument. Mr. Hall stated there was no provisions that had been provided for previously, and they added provisions in this deed of trust that shouldn't have been controversial, but there were. As indicated, the form of deed of trust that came over to be signed was inadequate, and the reason it was inadequate was because there was a pending sale transaction, and the document had no reconveyance provisions that were going to allow us to clear title. And so we're at risk of having a lien against the property that was going to impair the ability to close on the transaction, which would have impaired our ability to pay the judgment. Instead, a substitute form of deed of trust went over that had more standard language in it. And this is exactly why this is unenforceable, is because now we're negotiating after the fact about terms and conditions of a contract that should have been attached to the original agreement. So instead of having the process of then having to file a quiet title action to clear this inadequate deed of trust off the property, we just paid them instead. They had list pendants against the property as well, which is still a wrongful list pendants, but we took care of paying the judgment instead of entering into a whole new round of litigation about the adequacy. Now, Mr. Hall just told you that the contract is ambiguous. Okay, so we have an ambiguous contract prepared by his clients. How do we construe that? We construe it against the drafter. But I don't think it's ambiguous because it is very clear that the principal and interest are going to be paid. And, Your Honor, your distinction about the Bank of Cal case is very significant because it says whatever balance remains due. That's hugely different from paying principal and interest because they're saying we'll pay whatever's due as opposed to we're going to pay these two component parts of this obligation.
So, what do you think of his point? I mean, the thing is contract interpretation often is a question of fact, and this went to a trial, and there was testimony. This is his argument, and that even if a contract looks like it just only means one thing, isn't it true that under Berg, somebody can argue extrinsic evidence, can present it, and that a trial court can find that it means attorney fees or guarantee?
Except, Your Honor, in this case, we challenge that finding of fact, and also I will point to one more point that Mr. Hall brought up. He says, at the beginning of this, the Roberts were aligned with Severson. And that may have been correct, but it's very clear the Roberts are definitely aligned with the Secords later on with a special arrangement regarding their collection efforts. And so the credibility of the witnesses is a challenge, and so we have to come back to the actual document itself, review the words, and see if there is any ambiguity. We take the position it's very clear. Principal and interest means principal and interest and nothing more.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.